Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Dan Lynch joins me. We're going to be talking to my good friend Jim Brandt about all things Pearl. Where's Pearl 5? Where's Pearl 6? What's the Pearl Foundation doing about all of it? You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 472, recorded February 21st, 2018, The Pearl Foundation. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneAge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not aware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show. I bet this one's actually both of those today. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's good to be back.
Hey, yeah, and where are we speaking? Wait, no, I had it backwards already. Where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Liverpool or near Liverpool in the UK as usual, and I'm not Simon, which is strange. I've got less hair than Simon, but slightly similar beard. I know John was confused beforehand. Some of the Twitter people were a little confused that Simon's accents changed this week and he's lost his hair. But yes, it's all good.
Yes, we had to give Simon a break. I think he was on 4 out of the last 5 shows, so he's absolutely excused for at least another couple shows until he catches up in the current ratio of co-host to show topics. And for those of you that are watching the video, you can see that I am in my Tijuana apartment. Actually, my friend's Tijuana apartment, but I just stay here from time to time. Yeah, I'm in what we call the kitchen set. I kind of like that because there's all sorts of magnets on the refrigerator back there, and the lighting sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. Depends on how much light's coming from the big room over there. So, all pretty cool. But today is a very special show for me because, for 2 reasons, actually. One, you guys have all kept saying, why aren't there, my Pearl friends anyway, so why aren't there more Pearl topics on the show? You're the big guy in Pearl. How come you're not like bringing more and more Pearl things on? And I go, well, you know, because I got a lot of topics to cover. You should see the list of things I want to cover all the time. But today, the second reason this is good is we're going to be talking about the Pearl Foundation. And we're going to be talking with my good friend of many years and a former client, Jim Brandt. And Jim used to work at the University at Buffalo. I have to say that carefully because if we say of Buffalo, they get mad. He and I worked together for many, many, many years, especially during the late 90s when Pearl was really being rolled out big. The University at Buffalo, it was where I wrote my web framework, my infamous web framework, CGI prototype, and got them to allow me to open source it so that I could put it in the CPAN. So one of my biggest things I've contributed to the CPAN is, in fact, that. So I didn't have to do a lot of research for the show because I do know quite a bit about Pearl. I actually don't know all that much about the Pearl Foundation. So part of this is going to be me exploring what the Pearl Foundation is about. Jim is the current president of the Pearl Foundation. What are they responsible for? What kind of conferences do they create? I also want to put in sort of touch base with, where's Pearl 5 at? Where's Pearl 6 at? Where are we in the things? You know, Pearl 6 has been around for, 18 years now. So, I mean, at least from concept to deployment. So, Dan, what do you know about all this?
Well, unsurprisingly, I don't know quite as much as you, Randall, about Pearl. When you called me on, I was thinking, oh, he needs someone for the really technical, difficult bits, obviously. Maybe not. If you get stuck, just give me a shout. I'll fill you in. Now, I have used Pearl back in university days. So about 15 years ago, I used Pearl a little bit. And I can't confess to know as much about it, but still really popular language, as you know, and the Pearl Foundation really interested I'd like to learn more about that. And there's some other topics like CPAN, which I know we'll get into, which has had a massive influence on how other languages deal with distributing libraries and so on, and plugins, whatever you want to call them, and so on. Yeah. So yeah, loads to talk about there.
Well, one of the things I really want to cover in this show, and I'm sure Jim will be able to help out, is this notion that Perl is dead, and both on the level of Perl 5 is dead because nobody's using it anymore, and Perl 6 was never a full starter. And both of those notions are absolutely mythologically wrong. So I want to make sure Jim and I can really nail these two notions down. Now he's probably quivering like, oh, God, I have to explain why Perl isn't dead. Yeah, Jim, you're going to have to do that in a moment. But before we do that, I do have a very important message. Because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go ahead and bring Jim on. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Excited to be here. Excited to find out that Perl is, in fact, not dead, because I was just writing some this morning and it was all working. So I'm excited to find that out.
And Jim, where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from my home office in Buffalo, New York.
Buffalo, where we actually first met, I think. Did we meet at a conference before that? I can't remember.
I think we did. I think we met at an early OSCON, which, as you'll know, was the Perl conference for several years. And so they turned it into OSCON and brought in all the other languages. But it was originally the Perl conference. But I think it was OSCON already when we met.
Yeah. It was kind of funny because it was the Perl conference for like the first two or three years. And then it became the Perl conference with some more open source. And then it became sort of OSCON, of which the Perl conference was a huge track. And then it was just OSCON. And the Perl track became smaller and smaller. So it sort of disappeared.
Actually, as you're saying that, it's reminding me, it was in San Diego when Stonehenge, you guys set up, I think it was a Doom thing where you had computers all set up in the bar, like all networked together, and everybody could come in and just play those. That was the year that's the year that I met you. I remember that now. It was in San Diego. That was awesome.
You know, I miss those Stonehenge parties. I really miss them. We were the biggest party, the biggest unofficial party, because I never actually bought in to O'Reilly. There was some sort of funding you had to do to pay O'Reilly to have an official party. And so my buddy Bill Harp, rest his soul, used to set up these huge parties. And we made everyone think we were spending 20 or 30 grand, but in secrecy, it was actually about $5,000. And all I needed was one new client. I think actually you and I chatted at one of those parties, and I got to start working with you over at the university, right?
Yep. I think it all came out of that. So we started at that, and then we started working together on a bunch of projects at University of Buffalo. And then it led into, as we were working together on that, I ended up bringing Yapsi, which I think we'll get into, the conferences that the Perl Foundation gets involved with, brought Yapsi to Buffalo. And so while we were working together, we also had Yapsi in Buffalo. So yeah, there was all kinds of stuff going on at that time.
We should probably spell out that Yapsi is yet another Perl conference for the people, because there's a few people here who probably haven't heard of Perl, which is, I don't know why they're listening to today's show, but anyway, it's going to be great. Yeah. So the real reason I brought you here was because you have had the role of being the president of the Perl Foundation, for how long?
So I did it for a couple years. I've had a bunch of roles. I was conference chair, and then I was vice president, and then I was president for a while. And then Karen Pauly took over for a while. She was in for a couple of years, and then she stepped down a year and a half ago, I think. And then I came back in as president. So I've been on and off a few times. So I don't know. I haven't added it all up to see what the total time was yet, but seems like forever. No, it's a long time.
Okay. And has it always been called the Pearl Foundation?
So it has, but as you said, and this to get into like sort of the where the Pearl Foundation came from, it was originally created as a way to provide insurance for Pearl events. So as we talked about, the O'Reilly used to be the Pearl Conference before it was OSCON, and there were some people that wanted to get together. It was West Coast. People wanted to do some stuff on the East Coast. They wanted to have a small conference. They couldn't call it the Pearl Conference, so they called it Yet Another Pearl Conference. That's where the YAPSE comes from. So when they actually created things, it was called Yet Another Society. So, yes. So there were some different names for the Pearl Foundation when it first started out as Yet Another Society, which is a fun inside joke. But like YAPSE, Yet Another Pearl Conference, it was confusing for people who were not sort of in on the joke, if you will, like your boss when you're asking for funding to be able to go to this conference. So over time, we have, although it's still on the official documents as Yet Another Society, we added the, you know, the doing business as the Pearl Foundation so that people would understand who we were, what we did. And likewise, we're able to use the Pearl Conference name again for the conferences as well. So now the foundation name makes sense and the conference name makes sense.
Well, there are still YAPSEs all around the world. Are they also shifting naming to the Pearl Foundation, a Pearl Conference?
So North America has gone to the Pearl Conference. The EU, which are those are the two big ones, they both have gone to the Pearl Conference. Some of the other events still have used the YAPSE. And what we used to do is we would piggyback on the way modules are named in Pearl with the kind of double colon. So we would do YAPSE, colon, colon, NA, and that would be North America, and then EU, and then Japan, Brazil, Australia, and there have been events all over the world. And so sometimes they still keep the YAPSE name, and sometimes they're tacking on the Pearl Conference so that people know what it is. Sometimes there's also conferences as part of other open source conferences. So it'll be sort of almost like OSCON, where a bunch will be together, and then they'll do a YAPSE either attached to it or part of it. And I think you've gone to some of those in Brazil, at least. I know you've gone down there. So.
Yeah, definitely. I usually try to tag add along with going down to FISLE, which is apparently dead now, unfortunately, because the Brazilian government is in really dire straits, and so they've stopped funding parts of FISLE. But that was a huge conference because that was like 5,000 people, so it was a lot of fun. So let's talk about the Pearl Foundation again, because that's the reason we're chatting today. So the Pearl Foundation, 501c3, I think, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yep.
And so what sort of things do you get donations from, and where do you use those funds?
So we get a lot of our grant money, a lot of our donations from really it's the big companies that still use Pearl. And this is sort of back to the Pearl is very much not dead. It's running some huge applications, huge amounts of code at really big companies. So those are probably our bigger donations we get. So companies that everyone will have heard of, Booking.com, if you've done any sort of travel booking, you've used Pearl code, cPanel. And they provide sort of the web infrastructure behind a lot of hosting services. So depending on what your role is, you may have used cPanel, but you've probably used stuff that's sort of built on top of that. Craigslist, everyone's used Craigslist, big Pearl application. They're big Pearl users. So if you kind of go through and look at some of the companies that really rely on Pearl, want to make sure that it stays healthy, those are some of our biggest donors. We still do get donations from individual users, smaller companies that also rely on Pearl, want to make sure that we're supported. And then through events as well. Sometimes people give money right to the Pearl Foundation. Sometimes people donate specifically for like event type stuff. So we have things where we'll have a table at an event, so for hiring and things like that. So there's multiple different ways that funds come in, but those are the big ones that probably have the biggest impact are those big companies still using Pearl, rely on it, and they want us to help make sure it stays healthy.
And so where does that money go then? What do you spend it on?
So probably the two biggest expenditures that we have are, as we talked about, events. And the biggest one of those in terms of the spending that we do with the Pearl Foundation is the Pearl Conference in North America, in the U.S. So that's a big event that we have. We have all sorts of people come from all around the world, even though it's the one that's sort of based in the U.S. But we use a bunch of the funding for that. And then the other, really the biggest block of it goes to our grants program. And we have grants of all different types that we talk about. So there's an open grants program where anybody can come in on a quarterly basis and they can submit a grant and say, hey, I want to do this. I want to write this module that will help Perl. I want to do this thing. I want to do that thing. They submit it. There's a grants committee. They look through all the submissions, and then they determine whether they think that that particular thing should be funded or not. So that's one spot where money goes to. There's a few other grants that we have running as well, specifically ones that support the health of the Perl 5 language. And we have a couple of people that tackle, so it's open source, you know, P5P, and we get into that, Randall. You actually know that side of things even better than I do. But there are some sort of bugs, features, things like that that really require a person to sit down, sort of deeply think about it, and be able to sort of spend the time to fix it. So those are larger grants that we put out for really a handful of people that really know the Perl internals, and we make sure that they go through and get the critical sort of new features, if there's bugs, things like that. So we make sure that we fund those efforts so that those all get taken care of, and we don't just sort of wait for someone to pick something up and code it up and take care of it. And then the last bit is we're also involved in funding and taking care of Perl 6, and that's a similar sort of thing. There's individual grants. People can come in and say they want to do this or that or whatever, and then there's others that are specifically focused on the language, and right now they're focusing on things like performance, looking for optimization, speeding things up, things like that. So those are all the different areas that the grant money goes to.
So let's talk about Perl for a second, because that's also my favorite subject as well, because it paid my bills for many, 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 many years. So I'm really happy about that. Not to mention, I have a half dozen books and 255 magazine articles and all that sort of stuff on it. So I know a little bit about Perl, but let's explain to our audience, for those who probably haven't played much with Perl, because they think it's your granddaddy's language. I will say, though, I will confirm, Perl 1 through Perl 4, dead. Okay, so there are some Perls that are already dead. But what's really the current state of Perl 5 and Perl 6 at this point?
So Perl 5 is very healthy. It's in maintenance mode, but it's a very healthy maintenance mode. So just like many of the other projects out there have gone to really frequent updates. So if anybody who uses Firefox, you know that you get sort of the updates all the time with new versions coming out. It's probably 8 years ago now. There was kind of this gap in time where people were thinking, like, when Perl 6 was going to come out, that somehow maybe that was going to be like the next thing for Perl 5. And we could talk a little bit about that. They're really two totally separate languages. It's not like an upgrade from one to the other, and it's just like a seamless thing. They're two totally separate languages that both kind of feel the same and sort of have similar people in the different communities behind them. But once that was clear, about 8 years ago, a team around Perl 5 realized that they needed to keep sort of maintaining and keep Perl 5 healthy. And since then, there's been a Perl release every year. So they're on a very fixed schedule. They have met their dates every year. New features come out. Things are fixed where there's bugs. Security things come out. Important new things like Unicode updates. So when the Unicode consortium kind of comes out with new languages and things like that, because of this release cycle that Perl 5 is on, they're able to get those kinds of changes in. So that's been very healthy. And again, like every year. So many people, if you just look at your Linux distribution, whatever you happen to be working on, and you look at the Perl that's there, I think lately I've seen up to like maybe Perl like 5.14 or 5.16 in there. The latest release that's out, if you go to like Perl.org, is 5.26. So that's how much of a gap there is in sort of, you know, the continuing new versions of Perl that are coming out, and then what maybe a lot of people are used to and what they're working on.
Yeah, I'm a big FreeBSD user, and they're very careful about outdating any Perls that aren't actually being supported now. And almost all the machines I run on FreeBSD right now have a dead Perl because they won't support them anymore. So it's like a 2 year cycle from the time of publication.
So that's good. I mean, so the Perl community, it tries really, really hard to be conscientious, and this is one of the reasons, actually, as we get into talk about like the ways Perl is used. From a stability and sort of maintenance perspective, this is why a lot of people actually really like Perl, is because it's been very stable for a long time. There are not core fundamental things that change from one version to another. The team works really, really hard to make sure that if you wrote code, you know, X number of time ago, that it will continue to work. Like, I bet between the two of us, we could probably go through and name maybe, you know, a handful of changes that most people would have even noticed, even though maybe major things were changed internally for security reasons or for optimization or whatever the case is. The outward interfaces, they try really hard to keep them stable. So those old versions do tend to hang around, and everything in there, though, continues to work for the new versions as well. So it actually would be fairly safe for them to update. We do try to keep old versions. So if a security thing comes out, they will go further back than the dates that they've said that these are dead. So I guess it's probably doesn't encourage people to upgrade because they're like, oh, if it's bad, they'll come back and fix our old version. But yes, many of those versions are technically off the maintenance stack and they're not getting new updates and changes, like I said, unless something really bad came out and then the team might go back and fix those.
Well, you know, it's funny because I still maintain CGI prototype for my other main client, Insight Cruises. And I haven't had to change more than like three lines of code in the last 20 years in that. And that was related to the fact that CGIPM got unbundled. And so it had a different, slightly different interface that I was actually touching on that. So the code I wrote for you back 20 years ago is still working fine today on insightcruises.com. And I think that's a statement about how committed it's been to, and I think even Larry said like some old Perl 1 and Perl 2 will still run under the current interpreters. But let's get over to the size of the Perl community. Do you think that's slowly shrinking? In my experience, there's more Perl being done than ever right now. Is that also your experience?
Yeah, I think that's true. Also, if you look at whatever kind of stats you want to look at, I know there's a lot of stuff that's sort of clickbaitish where they come out in language popularity, like maybe Stack Overflow or the TOB thing comes out or whatever the case is. And they like to show percentages and they always want to show that. But I think the case is that IT is just so important in every aspect of our lives now that the pie is actually always growing. So, yeah, you might show, you know, any kind of percentages at any given time in a slice of, you know, whatever it is the group is that you're sampling. And it may show different percentages for language popularity. But in general, I think the amount of code that's being written, the amount of the software just is important in our lives in every aspect of it is always growing. So whatever stat you look at, I still think that there absolutely is growth in all these areas. Like those big companies that I mentioned, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of Perl programmers, and they don't all come in as Perl programmers. So almost by definition, they get added to the community when they take a job and they have some software engineering background, and then they learn Perl just as the tool that they're going to use at, you know, whatever it is, booking.com or Craigslist or, you know, cPanel or wherever it is that they're going. So those add to the community. The other stats that we can look at, again, outside of some of the general sort of trends are things like cPan uploads. We continue to see growth in cPan uploads. And by definition, those are people out there writing new Perl code. And it's not just updates to existing modules, like you mentioned, you know, maybe you updating, you know, CGI prototype or me updating some extension for request tracker or something like that. There is activity in all of those, but there's also new cPan modules. So this is new code that someone wrote. It's, you know, brand new, and it's going up and it's showing up on cPan. So we see all of those stats continuing to trend up. So I would agree. I think that, you know, the communities are still growing, and everything seems really healthy from all of those types of metrics that we can see.
And part of this has also been sort of formalizing the object system. You know, the invention of Moose has really sort of unified all the ad hoc systems that we use to create objects. And there's other things there too, like Catalyst, right?
Yes, that's right. Well, actually, and that goes back. It's interesting. We talk about CGI prototype and some of the stuff that we did. We were working on things sort of back at a time when all this stuff was still sort of churning around, right? So that we were just off of the original days of the dynamic web where people were using CGI for everything. You mentioned CGI.pm just being kind of removed from the Perl core. That's how everybody did everything. It was Perl scripts. That's why the Perl conference came about. All of the dynamic web, when it went from being flat HTML to dynamic web pages, was Perl, sort of back in the day, through CGI. And then there went through a time where it was the frameworks really weren't out there yet. All the things that people just take for granted now in whatever language they might use, the fact that you have a framework and you'll just pop that in and then you'll work on some templates and you've got a website, it kind of didn't exist. I think at that point, Catalyst was Maypole. I think you probably remember.
Yeah.
There were a couple of different names, right? So Maypole was just out. Some of the database abstraction layers were just out, starting to become available. And we were playing with all of them. We were doing speed tests, and we were trying to see where they were all going and how much they were going to change and things like that. So we would try them all out. And that's sort of where CGI Prototype came from, is because none of them at that time had a really good controller, right? They had the templating systems were out. So we had the Vue. And the database stuff. So we had the model, but it was that controller part. So that was the really cool part about CGI Prototype, is it kind of had that controller. And then more of the web frameworks came along and evolved. And so now we have, they're much more mature. We have things like Catalyst, like you mentioned. There's Modulicious, which is really cool. If people haven't sort of played with stuff, it's a really neat environment to develop in. And I think that if there's people who are used to other languages, whether it's like a Ruby on Rails or, you know, some of the other things where you can very quickly just develop something, I think they would find Modulicious very cool and very fun to play with. There's really neat developer modes you can turn on, and it gives you like tons of information right in the browser when you're developing about what's going on, and makes it really fast to develop things, lots of introspection to see what's going on. So there's all sorts of new cool frameworks that just weren't around back when we were developing all that stuff for UB.
Yeah, I'm also surprised that how little or how much I got right accidentally, I guess, with CGI Prototype, because again, as I'm continuing to use it for Insight Cruises, it just meets that nice sweet spot. I mean, the one real right thing that I did, besides it being prototype inheritance, which actually means you can move stuff around quite easily, is passing self into the template so I could call all these methods directly from the template code as well. And actually, Catalyst does a similar thing. They pass the C object in, so you can actually call controller methods directly from the template. I wonder if they were inspired by CGI Prototype.
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, the magic of it is if people go look at the module, I think it's less than 200 lines of code that you've got in that core section that really is the controller. And it's kind of solved that old problem. And if any of the people sort of listening remember back to the big challenge of CGI programming is when you came into a page, like think about like a typical form, right? What happens on a form? You fill it out, the person clicks go. The information comes in and you have to decide, you have to validate usually, and was that form submission good or not? If it wasn't, you have to redisplay the form again so they can fix it. If it was good, you're going to either take them on to the next page or you're going to process whatever it is, say thank you, send them an email, whatever the case is. And that was really challenging because you'd have to like have your pages be smart enough to say, oh, these are the different modes that I have to work in, things like that. And that's what that little block of code that you came up with really solved, because it allowed you to, like you said, through that prototype system, is you could decide at that point when you're rendering the page, what it is that you were supposed to do after you had taken care of what you had to. So if it validated, you can go render the next page. If it didn't, you're going to go render the past page. And I do think that I've looked at Modulicious, Catalyst. I do think they were probably inspired by that little bit of logic, because that was really the magic part. And if you ever look at code from sort of back in the old days, it was horrible the way people used to have to try to handle that. It was really difficult.
Well, I remember we considered for a moment. Now we're doing all sorts of nostalgia, but I remember at one point I was considering CGI : application, and somebody luckily online said, "Take a look at the main method there. It's completely monolithic. The entire code was monolithic, and that's part of what inspired me to break each one of those back into a method call so that we could override just some part of the logic or whatever." Anyway, enough about talking about us. Let's talk about Perl 6. What's the state of Perl 6?
So Perl 6 is out. I mean, that's the first thing that I would say to everybody. I know that it got like so much press early on, which I think was good, but I guess probably was also a little bit of a curse because you kind of got people watching and many open source projects, sort of like a band's first album, right? They've got, what's the old saying? You've got like 10 years to work on your first album and 6 months to work on your second album or something like that. So I think Perl 6 probably fell into that. They were kind of the second album and they didn't have all the time to sort of work in the background without people watching. But the old joke about, it'll be out by Christmas. Christmas has come and gone. It is out. It is available. Production. You can download it. You can check it out. Like I said, the stuff that they're working on now is, you look at something like, whether it's Perl 5 or really any of the other languages, many of them are at the, 20 plus year point now in terms of how long they've been around. That's 20 years of optimizations, based on feedback from people actually running it in, any number of production applications. That's the feedback that the Perl 6 team is kind of working on now. So they already know there's some obvious spots where they can start to put in these optimizations, these shortcuts in the underlying code that make Perl 6 run, that they can start to speed things up. But the more people use it, the more they can figure out sort of what's the low-hanging fruit. Like what are the things that, oh, wow, it turns out people do this thing all the time. That's worth it for us to put some optimization in because it's going to help, every Perl 6 program run faster or whatever the case is. So that's sort of where things are right now. And in terms of adoption, I think it's really interesting, again, sort of following in the footsteps. We talked a little bit earlier, we were joking about learning Perl and us preparing for this call. But, we joke, but it's real. That book launched so many Perl programmers. In fact, I mean, it was one of the first books that I got when I first started learning Perl, like way back in the 90s. I was doing some application. I was writing ADA for like a defense contractor, and I had to do something with these files and kind of move things around. And someone literally tossed the Learning Perl book on my desk and said, "Hey, this might help you out." I think they thought I was going to do it manually, and I was able to write a program to like update all these test files like super easily, right? So there's actually a Learning Perl 6 book, just kind of following that tradition that Brian Foy was able to crowdsource, and it will be released as an O'Reilly book. But part of the initial work effort on that was crowdsourced on Kickstarter, I think it was. So that should be coming out this summer. And, you know, again, just we're hoping that the success that Perl has had with learning Perl for Perl 5, where it really made it accessible, real examples, walked people through in a great way, exercises, the whole deal. I think that'll be a good way is if we can kind of replicate that with Perl 6, it makes it more accessible, lets people get into it. So that's pretty exciting. I think that should be coming out this summer.
And I'm glad Brian's working on that because he's been instrumental in maintaining my triage of books, Learning Perl, Intermediate Perl, and his Mastering Perl. He's been a trio. That's a different word entirely. Yes. And also, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm bragging a bit, but I think also the fact that we have an interactive web was made – at least greasing the skids was the fact that Perl was already out there on all these systems being used by IT, but something had to respond to the web forms that were coming up in the mid-90s, and Perl happened to already be there. Would you say that the interactive web might have been delayed a bit if Perl hadn't been around?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, any project that you look at where Perl became an essential component would have been delayed. I mean, if you go back, I mean, my recollection is that the CGI protocol, that's what CGI is actually a protocol, common gateway interface. Again, you know, people don't remember all this stuff. But it was a way for Apache to say, rather than serving an HTML file, which is originally what it did, is I can do something dynamic if you just give it to me through this protocol. And people were writing that in shell. Like that's actually how people were doing like dynamic stuff. And again, shell's great and it serves like a lot of different purposes. But I think that Perl just brought all this more power, flexibility, and speed. You could very quickly put something together. And then the text handling, because ultimately we were creating dynamic HTML pages, which was the text that we were sending out. So I think absolutely all that stuff would be delayed. And I mean, it's even the case today. I mean, Perl is just everywhere. Pretty much every system that you get is going to have Perl on it. It's going to have a system Perl. And many of the things inside the Linuxes and all the other systems we have use the Perl as part of like maintenance stuff that they do. I mean, Git uses Perl. I mean, there's just all sorts of things. I mean, Oracle comes with a packaged Perl. I mean, it's just it's everywhere still today. So
you've kind of touched on it on a sweet spot for me there, Jim, because I started when I was saying at the start that I did a bit of Perl back at university time. This would be early 2000s. I was doing CGI Perl. It was everybody had like a Slack, you know, a CGI folder in their website, and you put your Perl CGI program in there, and so on. But one of the things I was thinking about, you've already mentioned about web frameworks and so on and how, like, you know, there's now loads of great web frameworks for Perl. Do you think that the lack of like web frameworks early on affected some of the popularity, because people got really excited? It was like, oh, it's not cool because it's not Ruby on Rails, or it's not this, or it's not that. But as you say, Perl's still there. Do you think like they were a bit late getting to the frameworks possibly?
I don't know. I mean, my recollection is that, again, as Randall and I were working on, I mean, the ecosystem was developing at the time that we were writing all these web applications at the University of Buffalo, and they certainly hit templating right on. I mean, Template Toolkit was a very featureful templating language that was available, that essentially, like, if you had people that were coming from PHP and kind of had that, like, I like to put some HTML in here, but I want to be able to use some code and things like that, like Template Toolkit basically provided that, but then all of the other stuff that you could do in Perl in a more of a traditional coding way with objects and things like that on the side, which again was a little bit different from PHP at the time. So I think it was available, but if anything, I would flip it. I would say that the thing that sometimes, and I've heard this feedback, is that Perl's thing is there's more than one way to do it, and that bugs some people. Mm. So the fact that actually there were multiple frameworks, there were multiple templating systems that were available. Mason was available at the same time. That's what I used. You know, Request Tracker uses Mason still to this day. So there was that. There was Template Toolkit, and there were a couple of others. Catalyst was Maypole. It changed names. There were other people working on things. There were at least two or three. Randall, remember, you know, there was RoseDB. There was ClassDBI. There was DBIX Class. BIAX Search Builder is what RT uses. So there were like all these things. And actually, so I think it was the proliferation of systems in some ways that may have confused people a little bit versus Ruby on Rails. There was one. There was Rails. There wasn't any questions. Yeah. You didn't have to think, right? You didn't have to think about it. So.
Yeah, I know what you mean about the it's the kind of the model of the dictator versus, you know, the kind of free flowing thing. You know, if you've got one person saying this is how it's done, sometimes it's easier to market that, but it doesn't necessarily make it nicer to use as a, you know, as a platform or whatever. One of the things I was interested in is because I was looking, and I know Perl's way more than just web development. So, you know, I don't want to make people think that I only think it only matters in relation to the web. But I was looking today, and you've probably already answered this, but if I was to start with Perl today and I was going to say, I'm going to start a new web application, I'm going to use Perl, I'm going to use whatever framework I might choose, how is the kind of hosting environment out there? It feels like there's not as many people shouting, we do Perl hosting. Is that because Perl's already everywhere in every system, in all the Linux systems and stuff that are hosting these things?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't speak for all the hosting companies. I'm not sure exactly sort of the decisions that they make. You know, they have to sort of pay the bills and marketing and things like that. So I'm sure in some cases they're going to go with whatever they think is sort of exciting, and, you know, we'll get people to sign up for web hosting accounts and things like that. I do know that it's the things are still available out there. I think the two areas. So one of the old areas that people used to run to is being able to run ModPerl. So that was a technology that was invented, again, same era of time. People were writing all these applications. The way at the time to extend Apache, if you really needed high performance or if you needed to get into different parts of the Apache request cycle, was to write a C module. And C's hard. If you don't know C, it's very easy to leave, you know, memory leaks and just do all sorts of horrible things, really. You need to be a pretty accomplished programmer. So what they came up with was a way to write modules for Apache in Perl, which, again, was just much easier. That's what people were doing with C JavaScripts and things like that. And that's what ModPerl was. But it also just gave you like massive, massive acceleration in your CGI scripts. Even if you weren't like plugging into Apache or doing anything like that, like it would really get things going. But it did give you a lot of access to Apache. So many hosting companies, you had to get a special kind of account if you wanted to get ModPerl access. So that was one limitation people would run into. The other one is modules, right? So CPAN is the strength of Perl. Just unbelievable number of modules up there that do all sorts of things. Because of the volume of modules, many of them, you know, like some subset are going to be installed with your hosting provider or you know, that come included as packages with your various Linux systems out there, but not all of them. So when you need different modules that might not be in there, it'll depend on the hosting account that you have, whether you're able to go install new modules. But new tools out there like Perl Brew that allow you to install your full Perl into something that you own, like your user owns versus being like a super user, that has made that a lot easier. So you can very easily install, say, a new version of Perl. So you want to try one of the new versions and not the older versions that might have come with the OS. You can do that. And then within that Perl Brew Perl that you have, it's much easier to install modules. So I think both of those technologies have helped a lot to get through some of those limitations that people might run into in the hosting environments.
And I suppose the environment's changed a little bit now as well because of things like Docker and this, you know, the containerization. Everybody's big into containers now. They all want to run things in containers. It's less important whether you can find a host that says, yeah, we've got Apache, we've got Perl, we've got it all set up the way you want it. You really just want someone who can deploy your container or host your VPS or whatever it is. So there's a good chance for Perl to become a lot more popular again there, if you like, as well, because you know, everyone wants to deploy their own unique configuration of all this stuff together into containers, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's a great observation. And it does, it sort of gets away from some of those concerns that people used to have. When you have a language whose nickname is the Swiss Army Chainsaw, hosting companies don't always want to give you full access to that on the system, you know, understandably. But yeah, this new container environment where you can really kind of lock things off, I think does make it easier for the hosting companies. And there are people in the community doing work to automate that whole flow, what you described, which is basically writing your application locally on a laptop or whatever, getting it so that it does the entire deployment step through Docker. And so you can just sort of go through and deploy that, like literally like one command type deploys. And I've seen some great demos of people doing that. And it's in other languages as well, but definitely Perl has sort of all those bits. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you a bit about education as well, because I think Randall might have to cover his ears for a second. But one of the big reasons that people keep going on to me about Python is that that it's on things like the Raspberry Pi. Kids are doing it in schools. So is the Pearl Foundation looking at getting more into education and you know, in curriculums and stuff in schools? Because I know you can probably do just as much Pearl stuff on a Raspberry Pi as you can with Python, but it really feels like they've stolen the thunder in kind of making the big noise about the fact that it's on there. Is that something that that concerns you, or something that you're interested in, maybe more of an education angle?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The whole education thing has been something that I have been interested in literally going back to probably the late 90s or 2000, because working at a university, I'd go over, I'd talk to the people in the CS department, and they went through the whole phase where they would do C++, and that was the language that they would use for the curriculum through maybe end of the 90s. And then in the 2000s, they switched over to Java. It was probably the end of the 90s they switched to Java. And I would go in and ask professors, like even the languages courses that were like a survey of languages, nobody would do Perl. And I was like, why don't you guys do Perl? It's, you know, you can even show all sorts of different, you can do object-oriented, you can do functional, you can do all these different kinds of programming in one language. And what they told me at the time, and this was into the 2000s, is the students will get access to Perl on their own regardless, because it's just everywhere. They'll end up doing stuff in it. Whereas like some of the survey courses, they're going to do like Fortran or Ada or Pascal or things like that they may not do after school, right? So that was the answer that I sort of got back then. And I guess I would think that's probably the case now, is that it's just kind of so ubiquitous that people don't think about using it for certain things because there's just so much out there. I think from a learning and education perspective, there is so much information about Perl online. Like literally, if you just type like, you know, Perl, learning Perl, of course you're going to get the book, but then you're just going to get, I mean, there's so many websites that people have developed over time and maintained. And again, as we were talking about earlier, all of the basic code, even if it was a course that was built in like, you know, the early 2000s, it's all going to work on Perls today. So I think there are tons of resources out there. We do have some programs through the Perl Foundation to try to get new programmers to come to things like the Perl conference. So we do like a reduced rate, and we do have programs to get people into the community, because really that's almost as important as the language part, is getting into the Perl community, because that's where you get to meet people. And once you kind of have a face, you know somebody, you can send stuff. I mean, so much has happened in Perl just because of the relationships that I've had with people in the community, like Randall, for example, that is almost as important as learning the language. So yeah, we have done some things to try to sort of pull people in and try to help people along. And it's been pretty successful. There's some that we've followed and they've ended up with jobs at like booking.com and things like that. But I wish we could do more. It'd be great if we could get more people involved. And the Perl conference coming up this summer, there will be some of those types of reduced rate programs where people can come in. So if they're interested, they should go check it out. If people are just kind of learning Perl right now, if you're students, things like that, they should get to the Perl conference this summer.
Excellent. And that brings me on to some of the stuff I was going to ask about the conference. I mean, you've talked about some of the conferences like Yahtzee and stuff, which I've got. I said this to Randall in the back chat channel there, but I kept thinking you were saying Yahtzee at first, you know, the kind of card and dice game. So I wondered, does anyone ever turn up with their dice and their cards looking really disappointed at Yahtzee?
I don't think we've had that particular case. They do have a game night, though, and they may have played Yahtzee at Yahtzee. Yeah, we could do t-shirts made up.
Yeah. That's a great game. You mentioned the conferences, so you've got conferences coming up and stuff. Tell us a bit more about the conference side of things, because as you said, the community is huge, and we talked about education a little bit there, and I think there are so many resources. When I looked, I think it was a bit overwhelming almost. There was so much stuff online that I thought it would be quite daunting. So people should really get to events and meet the people and so on. So how can they do that?
Yeah, that's right. So I'm glad, first of all, just to have you validate that's been my perception as well. It's just as you said, is a case of whether, you know, the frameworks or the templates or whatever, you know, were things not there? They were there. There was too much. People get overwhelmed. It's the same with all the different resources and conferences and things like that. But yes, if you go to an event, you can talk to the people who can help you kind of sort through that and be like, oh, yeah, there's all these different things. But for what you just described to me, this might be the module to go check out, or here's the website to go check out. And that's where you can really meet the people. And the conferences are still small enough that you can literally, all these people, all these names and all the books that you might have on your bookshelf, they're there. And you can meet them and talk to them. They're all very approachable and fun to talk to. So we've got, again, we can call it the Perl Conference again, as long as we're very clear that it's not O'Reilly's Perl Conference. It's the Perl Conference, the community version of it. That'll be in Salt Lake. And that is this summer. That'll be in June. And then the European version, if you happen to be over in Europe, so maybe for your side of things, it's going to be in Glasgow this year. So I guess just north of you,
cool.
Right? So
yeah.
And that will be in August this year. So those are the two big ones. Japan used to have a really big one, but the organizer kind of got a little burned out. So it's year to year whether the Japan one's going to happen again. And then there are other ones that pop up all over. But yeah, the two sort of bigger ones that have been going year after year would be this year they'll be in Salt Lake and Glasgow. And they move around. So that's why I say the city. They don't stay in the same city. So we get different organizers and things like that. For example, last year, the U.S. version of the Pro Conference was in the Patent and Trade Office, which was really interesting for open source software, in Washington, D.C., which was really neat. And it was in Amsterdam last year in Europe. So they move around and it allows it to get closer to different people so that maybe they don't have to travel quite as far. But what's really interesting is we get a lot of people from the European community and the U.S. community that all come over to the one in the U.S. in June. And then they're all there at the one in August as well, August or September, whichever one the European one falls into. And then there's still a presence at other conferences and things like that. Like OSCON still has, some Perl stuff going on and all sorts of other conferences. So like you said, there's tons of stuff. The other thing I should mention, is we also have for the last couple of years have been putting videos of all of our talks online. So if you missed last year and you want to see, if you go to YouTube and just search for, I think the Perl Conference or YAPC, either one of those YAPC, will find, the channel where all those videos are, but you can see almost all of the videos from last year. So we put that stuff all out there, just like our open source code, open source talks, and you can go check them all out from last year. And there's some fantastic talks from last year and previous years.
Yeah. Excellent. And you kind of, I was just going to ask you about online resources as well, because obviously there's loads of great meetups and stuff, but you've also, you've got the IRC channel, you've got, of course, all the other resources, CPAN we keep mentioning, which I said I was going to ask you about, but I don't know if I really need to, because we've kind of talked about it quite a lot. But one of the things that I kind of, I suppose, from outside the Perl community really envied about Perl was CPAN. And I know I wasn't alone in that, because a lot of other languages went, we need something like that. So how do you think like the development of CPAN has influenced other languages and affected development of Perl and so on?
Yeah, I think people don't think about it unless maybe, you're a coder or you get into installing modules and things like that. But I don't think I can really overstate the value and the influence of CPAN. So for people who don't know CPAN, it's CPAN. It's the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network. That's what that stands for. And that's really the repository of all of the open source modules that people have built on top of Perl. And that's really the killer app of Perl. People ask me about that all the time. And that's really what it is. It's all of this repository of knowledge, 20 plus years of knowledge of all the different things that people have put together with useful code. And people have found out each language comes along. They build this community, all the open source languages, they build this community, same sort of infrastructure where people want to be able to put their code somewhere and have a central repository. And they do all kind of go through this. It is not a trivial problem. It is a really, really challenging problem to provide this distributed system for people from all over the place to be able to upload stuff. They need to retain the rights over their own stuff, but yet it has to be available to everybody. And the things that CPAN and the team that supports it have been able to do are absolutely amazing. They kind of separate. There's a pause, what's called a pause server, which is the Perl upload server. That's what the authors work through. And then CPAN itself is actually a whole set of mirrors. I think there's over 200 mirrors and there's pages that you can go to. I don't know if maybe we can link to them or whatever, but there's all over the world so that if a couple of mirrors go down, you can still get your CPAN code. So there's literally copies of it all over the place. And I know there's been some of the open source communities actually had issues because there were like central points that everyone would download from. Like when you downloaded a module, they all went through this one thing. And, I think that was an early thing that they said, we have to build this like the web. It has to be, replicated all over the place in case things go down. So there's just so much of that infrastructure that it is not trivial. It's amazing all the different resources people use to keep it all up. And it's been really resilient and a great system for years. And then MetaCPAN is the new search interface. So it even stays up to date so that it looks very modern and people can find all the things in metadata that they need.
And has it been influenced at all by the huge growth of like Git and things like that for version control, like the way you manage CPAN and so on? Or maybe it's the wrong way around. Maybe I'm asking that the wrong way around. Maybe Git was influenced by CPAN, I suppose.
Yeah, it could be a little bit of both, but I could definitely say, and maybe Randall would have something to say about this as well. We saw a whole wave of, because again, Perl's been around for a long time. Coder's been around for a long time. We kind of had the old CVS days and then Subversion. Everybody remember Subversion was like the big thing, like, oh, wow, this is so much better than CVS. Yeah. Everybody went to Subversion. And then there was like other, public repositories where people could like sort of host stuff and things like that. And then Git. came out, and pretty much, you know, many, many people, and now pretty much everybody has kind of gone over to Git. And you see that over time, people have moved the repositories around. I think that the big thing is becoming, with GitHub kind of becoming ubiquitous, like kind of the place where everybody puts stuff, it did allow for, not only do you have the distribution, the formal distribution up on CPAN, which is, hey, here's my published version, but a common place for all of the code to be. So yeah, people do have, and if you go to MetaCPAN, there's a link with each module that kind of goes to where the source code is. And I would say, I don't know, Randall, what do you think? 90% of Perl modules on CPAN, the repository is available on GitHub somewhere. So yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. And I suppose that we should have asked this at the start, really, but I mean, I was looking through the Perl Foundation website and documentation and stuff, and there's a lot of people involved. So how many members are there? How many kind of, you know, executive members and so on are there involved in all these decisions that you need to make?
So the board is fairly small. I think there's six of us right now. A few people have been around for sort of a very long time, and we're kind of just going through that, trying to bring some new people in and things like that. Get some crusty old people like me maybe to let somebody else be in charge for a while. So we're kind of going through that right now, but I think there's six of us. So that's small enough. We are worldwide. It does make doing a meeting like this where it's face-to-face a little bit challenging. We have Nat Torkington is in New Zealand, so he's kind of on the far end of things as far as the time. We have some people in Europe, which, you know, right in the middle, and then we have people kind of over here in North America. So it's a little bit challenging from timing. And then we have all the different groups that I mentioned. So the Grants Committee, they're a great group of folks, and they just kind of take care of their parts of things. I don't really need to get involved with that too much. They kind of know the process. And then there's other groups, like there's the groups that really put the conferences together. There's tons of work around the conferences, and that's probably one of the bigger groups. There's probably, depending on how you count it, you know, 20 active people at any given time with like a broader group that kind of grows as we approach the event, people who step up and say, hey, you know, I'm going to be there. What can I do to help? You know, things like that. So that's probably another one of the bigger groups that kind of has stuff. I don't know, if you add all those together, maybe, you know, 30, 40 people, things like that. There's a marketing committee that handles like things like Twitter and things like that. I'm sure they'll, you know, post a thing for this podcast after we're done. You know, they take care of all that kind of stuff. And then there's some groups that handle our infrastructure. There's tons of infrastructure for like the Perl.org when you go to those websites. And there's people. One of the things I was going to mention too, Perl.com, which we've been able to resuscitate recently. There's some people that support that. And then there's editors that take care of getting all the content for Perl.com, things like that. So yeah, I guess there is. Now you make me go through it. There are quite a few people doing things like all over the place. So yeah.
Cool. Hey, we're almost out of time. But before we get done with this long hour, we could probably go another 3 or 4 hours, of course, because you and I have tons of history in Perl and everything like that. We've covered quite a few things, but one thing we haven't covered yet is the Perl Zone.
Ooh.
What is that? Yes. How did that come about?
So there was a thing for a couple of years, maybe it was only 2 years, at YAPSE, again, what we used to call the Perl Conference, where the organizers would put together a little video. And this is right back when, you know, cameras were kind of becoming more accessible, and we had iMovie, you know, it was available, and you didn't have to have expensive software. So it's kind of becoming a thing to make movies. And I think that year, as I mentioned, we got YAPSE to come to Buffalo. It was 2004, I think it was. And you couldn't be there. For some reason, you couldn't be there. There was like you had some kind of scheduling conflict, right?
The cruise, right.
you're at UB doing consulting, and I said, I think I have a way for you to be at the conference. And basically, we took a weekend day. We came in. And very rough sort of script. I'll do it with air quotes. It wasn't really a script, but we had a general idea of what the scene flow was going to be. I think we whiteboarded it. And then me, you, a couple of my coworkers, we shot it all in one day. At the end of the day, we sat down, we loaded it from a camera that had a tape in it. People can remember these things. Actual tape. It was not, it was digital, but it was on the tape. Loaded it into your laptop. You did all of the editing, things like that. We put it together, and then we showed it at the end of the conference. And let me tell you, I mean, it went over like everybody's just freaking out. It was just great at the time. So yeah, we got to make this movie so that you could be at YAPSE even though you weren't there.
And so the theme of the movie, or the theme of the little short, it's only about 9 minutes long. We're not going to show the whole thing, but we are going to show a clip from it in just a minute. But let's set this up. So basically, you're just a worker, not just, but you're the worker. and then the role you had me play was based on Bill Lumberg from Office Space, for those who remember that. And your boss, Jim, the other Jim, played, who did he play?
Nick, the IT guy. It was a popular character on Saturday Night Live at the time. So Nick Burns, that was his name.
Yes, Nick Burns. So we had this mix up of two different shows. Yeah. And I remember to prepare for my role, we had talked about this. And I went back and watched Office Space twice the night before, just so I'd have the right exact sort of pacing and everything that Bill Lumberg had in that movie. Because that's one of my favorite movies. Actually, one of the few movies I carry with me all the time in my iPhone. So I can always watch it when I have a moments to delay on that. So the whole – if you just Google the Pearl Zone, Randall Schwartz, this is the first hit that comes up. I don't know why my name makes it come up quicker, but it doesn't if you don't. It's also in the show notes. So if you go to the homepage for this show later today, you'll see it's also there. But we're just going to play right at the end only because I love the line that you gave me to say. So, John, you want to go ahead and play that?
Hey, Bill, how are you doing with that Pearl train? Now that we've converted everything over to Pearl here at the company, we just want to make sure everybody's up to speed.
Hey, Peter, not very well. I'm really not getting most of this.
Okay, well, I see you got all your books here. So, and if you have any questions, you be sure you call Nick.
Nick, no.
Yep.
He's giving me hell for not having read this book yet.
Well, just remember, Bill, we do everything here for the company, so you just want to make sure you keep that in mind. And if Nick's your guy, you'll just have to give him a call. Well, hang in there and let me know if you need another copy of that memo about the Pearl training.
Hey, wait, before you go, what the hell is a Schwartzian transform?
Thanks, John.
That was, yeah, the whole movie is it's a 9-minute lead up to that punchline.
Yeah, and for those who are not watching the video, that's actually all of the whole stack of Pearl books. It actually just came off of your desk, I think.
It was off my shelf. I just carried them in the other room. Yeah. Yep.
That was so cool. So one thing we haven't really addressed, but maybe you're a good person to ask that. Like I said, we're almost out of time, but why would I pick up Pearl today?
So I think we mentioned it as we went through, CPAN is still the killer app of Pearl. Even today, I go through and we have a new problem. I'll be doing something. As I mentioned, I work at Best Practical. I work on Request Tracker. People want to do an integration with something, or they want to do this, they want to do that. And I'll go and I'll see if there's a module there. And there's almost always a module. It's got a recent update date on it. So someone has been actively working on it. So that's one of the big things. There's almost always a module to kind of tie in, so you can focus on the part that you need to work on and not sort of have to build foundational things for a lot of stuff. It's everywhere. And again, it's being actively maintained. If things like Unicode and internationalization and support for things like that are important to you, Pearl is almost one of the first ones to get the new versions of Unicode, things like that. And like I said, there's more than one way to do it, right? So there's often multiple options for the different things that you want to do. It may take a little research to figure out which one. The reality is there's people using probably all of them. If you kind of find it in a search, whether it's Catalyst or Modulicious or whatever the case is, they're probably all going to meet your needs. I think there's just a lot of options to get you up and running quickly so that you can focus on getting your problem taken care of, because that's really ultimately whatever you're working on, you have some goal. And I think Pearl is probably one of the best suited to get you to your goal quickly.
And I'll add to that one extra thing there, which is I'm noticing as a Pearl consultant, is that I'm actually hearing of managers that are moving away from Pearl because they can't find enough qualified Pearl practitioners. In other words, there are not enough Pearl programmers in the world right now. So learn Pearl for that reason, if nothing else. There'll be jobs that may not be down the street from you, but if you don't mind moving around a little bit, there are definitely shops that are still hurting, looking for Pearl people, like Booking.com you mentioned. I know my friends are always talking about, move to Amsterdam, have a great job there. But I'm not moving to Amsterdam anytime soon, apparently. So anyway, Jim, it's been wonderful having you on. Is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to make sure we covered in this too brief a time?
Yes, I feel we could do like a whole nother show. I guess I'll mention real quickly, the conferences I already talked about. Pearl.com is back. It was a little bit dormant for a while. It's a great example of what we can do. The Pearl Foundation needs people to come in and do things. There was David Farrell was running Pearl Tricks, separate site. There was a blogging thing. And we talked to each other at the Pearl conference. We got together and he said, hey, what about Pearl.com? We're able to work together and resuscitate Pearl.com. There's articles on there going back to 96, I think, with all sorts of Pearl information. Some of it's still relevant. I mean, most of it's still relevant. I was reading through some of it. I'm like, all this stuff is still good today. 20 plus, that's definitely 20 plus years worth of stuff. for if people want to get involved, there's lots of stuff in the Perl Foundation that are not code related, like getting this Perl.com going again. So if people are interested, I'd like them to, you know, sort of contact us. And there's lots of projects that aren't just writing code that very much help the community, that being one example. And also people can contribute to Perl.com. If you want to write an article, there's information on the site and how to do that. So.
Yeah, I can't tell you the number of times I've had a question about something in Perl, and I said, I think I know how to, I've done this before. I don't remember how, though. And I Google for it, and it ends up on one of my 255 magazine articles. So I went, oh, now I know why I know how to do it, because
yeah,
I did
so
it.
Much so much information out there for, you know, for things that were done. I mean, even, you know, you Google stuff, and, you know, Stack Overflow is a big thing now, but in a lot of ways, you know, we Perl kind of had Stack Overflow. We had Perl Monks. If anybody who's not familiar with Perl Monks, if you go to perlmonk.org, it doesn't look as nice. They definitely, the design, they did a beautiful job on Stack Overflow. But if you look at the basic system of Perl Monks, it's kind of what, you know, kind of evolved into Stack Overflow. And many of the answers, when I Google stuff, you know, when I go look for stuff, I find it on Perl Monks. So
yeah,
it's still
I do
there.
Too. Definitely find some stuff there too. Okay, two final questions. I think I know the answer to one of these.
Okay.
What's your favorite scripting language?
I think it's Perl. Yeah.
Yay! I got one. And what editor do you spend all day in?
I spend most of my time in TextMate, actually. I do. I'm an Emacs guy when I'm on a system for Emacs type stuff, but I'm on the Mac. I've gone to TextMate.
Okay, well, that's a half a point. So I got 1.5 points this time. Jim, like I said, we could keep talking, but we're really out of time right now. Thanks for coming on, talking about the current state of affairs with Perl, and also letting us delve into some history together. So that was really fun. So, Jim, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for having me. It's great being here. Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks. That was Jim Brandt, my friend of many years and former client, talking about Perl. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, it was great. Really, really good to hear from Jim about what's happening with Perl and stuff. And one of the things we were talking about was, I mean, you mentioned at the start, I'm glad you said this and I didn't, that it's your granddad's language or your dad's language or something. That's the way some people see it, but it's still very much around. And I think in some ways, Perl suffered from being like the first guy through the door. It was easier for other people to, you know, get in after because so much stuff was done first in Perl. And I've just looked up, I looked up before we started Mojolicious. I was looking at different web frameworks. So I'm going to have a little play around with that and see how it goes.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Perl, Tickle, and Python all started at pretty much the same place. And where's Tickle now? Gone. not even anywhere except the AOL web server that was sort of the embedded language for that. Or if you're using Tickle TK, it's also there, but there's also Perl TK that was modeled on that, so that was nice. But yeah, I mean, and Python started roughly only like a year or two after that. So I think once people got angry at Perl by having all the sigils, you know, it's like sigils were absolutely a benefit, thinking it from a programmer's point of view, but it really made Perl look ugly, and that's part of the reason people rejected Perl, because it looked ugly. And I'll have to say also that I accidentally contributed to Perl's reputation there because I created the JAFs, the Just Another Perl Hacker things, and everybody started modeling those, and everybody thought, well, that's what real Perl is. But no, that was never real Perl. It was make-believe Perl. And then people started doing Perl Golf. I didn't invent Perl Golf, but I think those two things basically contributed to this notion that Perl's a write-only language. And if you Google Perl write-only, you actually see hundreds of references to it over the net. And I think that's I'll take part blame for that because the JAFs were definitely crazy stuff. Anyway, we're out of time, so I got to talk about upcoming guests. Next week, GitLab, which is the open source GitHub, local or hosted, so that'll be fun. Gitcoin after that, which is the easiest way to monetize or incentivize Floss work. So you could have, for example, on your GitHub page, you could have solve this bug and I'll pay you some Ethereum. Kind of cool. SUSE, which is a very old, very popular Linux distro. Etsy Viper Builder, which is, I don't know much about it, except it's scaffolding for building apps in a clean way with the Viper architecture for iOS development. So it's an open source way dealing with applications you might want to put in the iOS App Store. Rust, the programming language. That's from Mozilla. It's a systems programming language that runs blazingly fast, prevents seg faults, and guarantees thread safety. Just added to the schedule between last week and this week is the OWASP Dependency Track, which is a software composition analysis platform, similar to what we had a couple weeks ago, that keeps track of all third-party components used in all the applications an organization creates or consumes. So it's a great way of watching the CVEs and stuff that come out all the different places that bug trackers announce things, and then you can say, do I have one of these somewhere deep in my stack? So that's really cool. Pigeon, LivePurple Game, which is a multiple chat protocols like IRC and the old AIM protocol that's now dead, but things like Yahoo protocol, things like that. So that's going to be cool. That's all I have on the current list right now. I'm working on a few in the background. If you go to twitch.tv/floss, the homepage for the show, you can see who I'm working on and also get my email address there, which is merlin@stoneedge.com. That's on that page. And if you have any other suggestions, again, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me. We have live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. You can come in and watch us do our show and see what kind of mistakes we make behind the scenes, and also ask our guests the questions, and we'll forward those to them. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter, and follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. And I have two messages from the home office. Did you know that Twit Flash Briefing is now available in Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, even for you, and India? It's been in the U.S. for a while, so now is the perfect time to go to your Alexa app settings, and under the Flash Briefing, look for Twit. And also, it's time for our yearly Twit survey, and we want to hear from you so we can serve you better. Head over to twit.tv/survey and be heard. I will be at SoCal Linux Expo, also called Scale, in a couple of weeks. I'll be presenting a talk on Flutter, which is the way to build iOS and Android applications with one code base. I'm actually going to be joined on stage by a very special guest, which is going to be fun. And I'll also be there surveying people for Floss Weekly upcoming shows. Dan, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, very quickly, I want to mention that there's only 1 week left to submit an application if you want to be part of Liverpool Makefest, which I've talked about before. It's at Central Library in Liverpool. It's going to be on the 30th of June this year coming up, so a little bit later in the summer. It's about 3,000 people or more there, so it's pretty big. Lots of people making things, you know, things with LEDs, things without LEDs, all this kind of stuff. So if you're interested, the applications close at the end of February, so we got 1 week from today. If you search for Liverpool Makefest in a search engine of your choice, or you can follow a link that I'll give to the guys to put in the show notes to lpoolmakefest.org, and you just fill in a quick form there, get involved, it's really good. Or you can find it on my Twitter probably as well, which is for those watching in the bottom there, at Method Dan. So yeah, get involved, it's really good, and a great way to share, you know, the love of technology and programming and robots and all kinds of cool things with everyone.
I didn't realize that was the bifurcation of the world, that's the big division. Things with LEDs, things without LEDs.
It's kind of the new wipers up, wipers down, although we're doing a callback to a joke that was before the show, so never mind. Sorry.
Yeah. That's great. Hey, Dan, thanks a lot for stepping up and joining me for today's show. You asked some really wonderful questions. I appreciate that, even though Pearl's not your wheelhouse. It's more of mine, but thank you very much for joining me again today.
No problem. Always great to be here. See you again soon.
Great, and we'll see you all next week. See you all again next week. There we go. How about the whole English, Randall? We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.